Hello, listeners. Surprise, surprise. This is Carolyn Yeager hosting a special podcast with Londoner Dr. Nicholas Kollerstrom, who has a new book out titled How Britain Initiated Both World Wars. It's a small book that began as a talk he gave in two parts on the subject, and the book retains the conversational feel of a talk. It's only 99 pages and is priced at an easy 4 English pounds, or 4 quid, as he puts it, or 5 U.S. dollars. It's illustrated, too. You can buy it at Amazon. Just look up Nicholas Kollerstrom, Amazon, to see all of his books. I think there are 8 in all. Dr. Kollerstrom, an astronomer formerly of University College London, is a seeker into truths that society has labeled taboo. That is why he has the distinction of being the sole member of University College to be expelled for ideological reasons. He looked into how the insecticide Zyklon had been used in World War II and formed an opinion that did not kowtow to the official narrative. That was the end of Dr. Kollerstrom's career. So it's an honor to have Nick Kollerstrom on the mic with me to talk about what conclusions he's come to about who is most responsible for World War I and World War II. A big, big topic, which he condenses down so nicely. The interview, which took place on Tuesday, June 21st, starts abruptly and begins with his thoughts about the Brexit campaign taking place in Britain. I have to apologize for an echo when Nick is speaking, which is a little disturbing. I cleaned it up as best I could, and I hope you will persevere in listening because what Dr. Kollerstrom has to say is so very much worth it. Here goes. All right, Nick, we're recording. So how are you doing? Tell us what your opinion of what's going on in Britain right now.
This is the most extraordinary moment, Caroline. The whole nationalist independent movement is being sabotaged by a shabby trick. I mean, there was a 6-point lead for the Brexit vote to pull out of the EU, you know, and get our nation and sovereignty back again, right? Despite we have massive propaganda, non-stop propaganda from just about everybody about how we should stay in, you know. But despite that, the British people were wanting to pull out because I think a lot of people realise that the destruction of the white race is the agenda of the EU, you know. And then suddenly we get this alleged death of somebody called Joe Cox by somebody who's clearly just a patsy. You know, he's a very quiet, gentle fellow, not known for any political views, whatever, or ever any violence at all. And he's alleged to have hacked out of bits and stuff up north. And there's absolutely no pictures of a dead body. Absolutely no blood anywhere, and it's all about as phony as it can be, and we're getting massive propaganda from this day after day, with court hearings and funerals, Parliament recalled, and it has succeeded. It's destroyed the Brexit majority, and it's done so with Jewish-type propaganda of hate, and love, that this guy stands for hate, who tried to attract her, and he allegedly yells, Britain first, as he did it, right?
Right.
So, Britain first is obviously a code word for far-right, loony, nutcase.
Right, so are you questioning whether he really called out Britain first?
Well, they later on denied it. Later on, it turned out, oh no, there's no witnesses for Britain first.
Oh.
After that had gone around all the newspapers, then came out, oh, no, sorry, nobody heard him say that. No, that's some sort of mistake. And nobody called that out. And that's just the way the whole thing has gone on, with one bit of story after another.
Mm-hmm.
But it's had the effect of they've linked up pro-British, pro-independence movements with hate. Hate, far-right Nazi, and they've claimed that this guy gets Nazi propaganda, okay? And some Jewish-type group in America called Hate Watch put up a post on the 16th. Now, I don't know if you're in some funny numbers, Caroline, but this happened on 666, the date of 666, right? 16 June 2016, okay?
Oh, I didn't connect it. I noticed, I remember when that day came up, I said, wow, what a number this is. This is some kind of a day. But I didn't connect it with being, that Joe Cox murder day.
Yeah. Well, that's come up. An American website then goes up on that same day, right?
Right.
Something called Hate Watch, which is obviously a Jewish thing, claiming that some Mueller, he's the patsy, right?
Uh-huh.
It's in 1999, that's many years ago, that he ordered some far-right literature.
Right.
Nationalist literature, okay?
Yeah.
And so nationalist is obviously, can then be translated into far-right and hate and so on. Now, how did they get documents from 17 years ago on that same day when that guy was only just a suspect? He was just a suspect, that's all. And it's obviously pre-planned. For that to go up so quickly on that day, the 16th, on an American website, you know, thousands of miles away, claiming that this guy ordered some far-right literature from many, many years ago, before he's even been charged with anything.
Well, right.
You know, that's a totally pre-planned event. It has to be.
Okay, I get you. Well, you know, I'm always hesitant to make these kind of assumptions, but you've been following this type of thing for a long time, and
I have indeed, yeah.
It's very interesting that you've come to this conclusion. Well, we know that when something is as important to them as the EU is, they'll do anything, you know, to make it go the way they need it to go. It did seem like it was awfully fair-minded all along, you know, nothing much was happening. Because they thought they were going to win. And as soon as they thought they weren't going to win, it looked like they might not win, then they pulled out their bag of tricks.
I'm talking about fair-minded. I mean, we read, for example, stuff through the Post delivered about why we should stay in, and nothing allowed about why we should go out. It's just big funding and endless TV and news stories about why we need to stay in and how terrible it would be if we come out. It hasn't been balanced at all. There have been just about two. It's about two British politicians who say we should come out, and that's it, you know. So it's an outrageously biased thing. And this is just a psyop. It's what's called a psyop that's done the week before, and it's worked, you know. And when the truth comes out, it will be too late. And they'll just say, oh, you're just a conspiracy theorist,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think, but, yeah, it's very, very, very depressing. But do you think that if the Remain wins by a small margin, and all this is being talked about, and so many people, that there's half the people, just like in the Austrian presidential election, there's half the people who are not happy with the outcome, and they're not going to just stay quiet and not keep working at it. So I don't know how they think they can keep this EU going when it's so unpopular.
It's very important that the nationalist movement gets the correct agenda. That this is a fixed-up job, it is a psyop, we should not accept that this woman is dead. I mean, you know, you have to see the funeral friends with her family, and they're all sort of grinning, and there's no real grief at all.
I didn't see any of those pictures. I didn't see anything about the funeral. So they filmed it, it was on television, and the family members were...
Yeah, I just put it up on my website. That's Terror on the Tube, by the way, Terror on the Tube. And it's my latest post about this fake death of Joe Cox, you know.
Yeah, terrorontheTube.com.
.co.uk, and that's, just have a look at it. Everything is bogus about the event. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't believe that guy did anything. I don't believe he did it. I do think he got out a knife and started hacking her when... in broad daylight in the middle of town where various other people were around, and then he got out a gun and started shooting her, and then he just walked away, and she's still alive. None of that makes sense, you know, there's no blood on the pavement. It's a totally balmy story, you know.
There's no blood on the pavement.
No blood on the pavement, no. Nobody's seen that shown any blood anywhere.
I never saw a picture, that, you know, they say they didn't want to show that stuff, but all I ever saw was a picture of that man. I never saw an image of her.
You only see one picture of the man. You know, so only one picture you ever see of the man. You see no pictures of any wounded or dead body. And you get various witnesses who are also a different story. We've all got a different story. You know, I mean, coached in some way, but, so I'm hoping the story's going to fall apart, you know.
Yeah, well, there's only 2 days. We're recording this on Tuesday, and Thursday is the vote. So by the time I get this on the air, it will be already have passed.
Yeah. Anyway, these things have consequences, Caroline, you know. I think we just have to work with what we've got. This is the tactics of deception. I always think of the first verse of the Protocol of Zion. It says, let our countersign be force and make-believe. You know, you do need to realize that the power managing this 20th and 21st century works through force and make-believe. And there is always deception involved by the powers that want to take over this world, take over our world.
Well, that's right. I agree with that 100%.
Well, I think we're getting to a stage where most people don't believe the Holocaust story anymore, except maybe in America. I think you're in one of the few countries where a majority of people are so brainwashed they still believe it. But, you know, I think most places is falling apart. It really is. That book, The Bad War of a Mike King, you know, I think that's influencing a lot of people now. And that never ever happened before.
Yeah.
You know, like that thing online, The Great Story Never Told about the life of Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people are seeing that and they're just getting a different view.
Yeah.
And I think there's a huge, people have told me, this is a huge, when I brought out this little booklet, you know, I've initiated Bad War Wars last month or so, that I would never have dared to do a few years ago. People have told me about what they feel is a huge swing in opinion taking place now, and I think it is really big. That's my impression.
Well, let's take a look at your book.
All right, yeah.
You know, How Britain Initiated Both World Wars. Well, I love that title, and I bet a lot of people still don't know that book has come out. I wanted to read it right away. I did read it. Of course, I have it. And I'm so glad you did it because...
thanks very much, Colin. Yeah.
Well, I am because it doesn't take long to read. It's not a great big tome, you know, that people have to go through. And it's very short, and it gives all a lot of quotes from people during the time, and it just gives away what they were up to. And so it's an easy way to learn about how to look at these world wars outside of the, general consensus that's put out there. And so why don't you, now I just wanted to mention that this is the 100th anniversary of the World War One still, because it was
from
August 1914 until November 1918, and
I think the terrifically important moment is this December, right, 2016. That is the 100th anniversary, it will be, of the German peace offer. I think that's a terribly important, that's in a way the last opportunity for humane culture and civilization in Europe, you know. Germany said, look, we're not quite sure why anybody's fighting this war, but whatever it is, can we just stop it? Can we just go home and be friends again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's called status quo ante. You go back to where you were before, okay?
Right.
I think I believe that America, the then president said, yeah, look, this is a good offer. Why can't Europe accept it? Good offer from Germany. Why can't we all just accept it? And Britain wouldn't accept it. Because if it had, it wouldn't have been able to explain what the point of the war would have been. It needed to sort of crush Germany or smash Germany or whatever, and then it could blow up whatever the point of the war was supposed to be. But if we all just went home again, it wouldn't be easy to explain to everybody why so many young men had gone out to fight and die in the trenches. That's the way I see it.
Right, and then it was just a few months later that the United States came into the war.
Was it? Yeah. When did America come in?
Well, I thought it was early in 1917.
Right, yeah, okay. So anyway, that's our anniversary, as you point out, 100 years going on.
In 2014, everybody talked a lot about the anniversary of World War One, but it's gotten very quiet now, but it really should continue until 2018, the discussion of it. So that's another good reason for you to have written this book.
Yeah, that's a point, yeah. Yeah, well, perhaps I could say that composing it was enormously stressful for me, just doing this, and having the courage to do it, And my friend, who I do this, you know, a monthly sort of group that meets, and he urged me to give a talk on it in a way that I sort of felt I was obliged to, because I had mentioned it before. And so I gave this talk. It was 2 one-hour sections, and somebody recorded it. He recorded it. So I was then able to transcribe what had been recorded, and I polished it up a bit and put in some references.
Sure.
But it's still got the flavour of a live talk, hasn't it?
Yeah, very much so, yes. And that's another reason why it's pleasant to read, easy to read, and it's entertaining. It never gets heavy, and it's very, very informative. I mean, you really pick up a lot of good information about what was behind it all. And I think we need to understand World War One, and most people don't. And
no, no.
You know, there's
this. Most people think Germany started it.
It was just all these European rivalries, and there was no way to avoid it. You know, it was all these big egos running around Europe,
exactly,
and we couldn't avoid it. It just was going to happen. And
exactly,
you make it very clear that it could have been avoided. So why don't you talk about that, how it started?
Yeah, well, that is the traditional view, which I've always taken on my life, that it was just, as you said, big egos clashing, instability of Central Europe, and nobody wanted it. At the end of the world, everybody says, oh, it wasn't us. No, we didn't want it. Oh, we didn't start it. No, don't blame us. And then Germany is compelled, in the Treaty of Versailles, at gunpoint, to sign the total blame and responsibility for starting the war. And then everybody walks away from it. That's it. It's Germany's fault. Which is a totally absurd scenario. And it's basically crushing the spirit of Germany. I came at it actually reading this Austrian philosopher, Rudolf Steiner, and he gave lectures in December 1916, while his peace offer was on the table, about the war and who was responsible for it. And he said that there's no possibility of a desire for war from Middle Europe. It just isn't there. Germany just wanted culture and trade. I was brought up with the idea in my youth, I read this Austrian philosopher, Rudolf Steiner, and he gave lectures in December 1916 saying that a desire for war could not in any way come from Middle Europe, that Europe just basically wanted trade and peace.
Mm-hmm.
And the British Empire was enormously larger than anything Germany had got. He said the desire for war came from the powers behind the British politicians, and he obviously meant sort of Freemasons and that sort of thing, hidden occult powers that actually wanted the war, and I think that included the King of England. He pointed to this meeting on the 1st of August, when the German Ambassador Lichnowsky met the British Foreign Secretary Grey, and gave him this was Germany's final attempt to get a deal, and Lichnowsky asked him if Germany promised really conditions under which Britain would agree not to attack Germany, if Germany promised the integrity of France, even would Britain promise not to attack Germany? If Germany was desperate not to get into a war with Britain, it's any desire to invade France was basically defensive. This is what a lot of people don't get, that France and Russia had paired up and were planning and were just about to attack Germany.
Yeah, let's go into that a little bit more so people understand. In the beginning, and say around early
1914.
Pardon me?
June or July 1914.
Yeah, then Russia and France, you say, both wanted war. Why did Russia and France want war?
Well, they were both wanted land, which they reckoned belonged to them, which Germany had got. France, it was Alsace-Lorraine, and Russia, it was some part around Constantinople. And they both reckoned that war was the only way to get the land back.
So, yeah, I've read that before, but so France was willing to go to war just over Alsace-Lorraine.
Well, there was also the sort of national honor that they felt there were events in the past they wanted to avenge.
Right. So they wouldn't have conceived of the size that this war grew to be at that time. They didn't want a world war.
By Christmas. So. Well, everybody thought it would be over by Christmas. Something.
There you go. Right. So,
you know, look, we can fight this quickly and get it over with. And then
you said that Serbia also wanted war, but with Austria.
Yes, wanted war with Austria because it had dreams of a greater Serbia, and you knew that Russia would back it, and you reckon it to take off some land from Austria, in Austria. And this assassination of the Archduke, that was part of a sequence of events designed to annoy and infuriate Austria, and so Austria felt it had to respond to it.
Right. So everybody wanted to get a little bit more for their own country at that point.
Yes. It was kind of biologically linked to Austria because they had been the same country for many, many centuries. You know, the ruling class of Germany, mm-hmm. ruling family, had been in Austria. And let's remember, Germany had only created the boundaries in 1871. Mm-hmm. So the problem came from those boundaries of Germany, that there were there were people who were German outside those boundaries, and it was in a way the Austrian desire to hit Serbia, get revenge, the assassination, that kind of dragged Germany into this conflict.
Right, and then
right at the end of July, the wise German Kaiser just was very firm with Austria. He said, look, you can just go send your troops into Serbia, don't kill anyone, no action, just go in there and as a show of force until you've inspected and find out all your investigation who you think the assassins are for the Archduke being bumped off. So you can go into Serbia and then come out again, and that is all. He was very firm, and they did not follow his instructions. That was because they wanted to hit Serbia.
Mm-hmm.
So they started shelling Belgrade, and that, as it were, led to the escalation.
Right, but before that, the point is that Russia and France were on either side of Germany. So it was a kind of a, and then Serbia was right below Austria. So that was a kind of a encirclement type of idea that they had,
yeah.
That they thought they could.
Germany would still have been okay in terms of solving the conflict. Germany was a mighty power, and if it were not for what Britain did, the Kaiser's policy would have prevailed.
Right. Russia and France knew that they alone couldn't defeat Germany and Austria, but they knew from the beginning they wanted to get England into it. And you've made the point, or maybe some of the people you quoted made the point, that they would never have gone ahead with it, Russia and France, if they didn't believe that England was going to, or I should say Britain, was going to
That is the crucial thing, what you just said there.
And you know, these are exact parallels to what happened in World War II, or you can make the parallels. Well, we'll do that later.
Yes, it's all a very similar process. So Churchill, this has got missed out on most English history books, most people don't know this. Churchill sent the entire British Navy, which is the largest in the world, in full battle readiness, up north of Scotland on the 28th, went up there, and as the Kaiser said in his memoirs, when he saw that had happened, he knew that the war was coming. Everyone felt there was horrible instability in Europe, all these alliances, and would a war break out, and was it inevitable? And the warmongers said, look, it's inevitable, it's going to happen anyway, so we might as well start it, right? That was the view of the warmongers, and certainly, I think, of Winston Churchill. He just sensed it was coming. He sensed his exciting destiny ahead. He knew he loved war, and he was First Sea Lord, so he could do it. And he did that without the cabinet's permission. I doubt if Parliament even knew it had happened. The British fleet was sent up north, and that was the signal to all the warmongers that it was going to happen. And that was when that brought in a totally different agenda. You see, up till then, the various countries had been looking at Eastern Europe, Austria and Serbia, and saying, oh goodness, how can we defuse this? And then on the west of Germany, nothing to do with that conflict, the whole British fleet is then waiting, poised outside Germany, and it's there to establish this total blockade to stop any food getting into Germany, mass starvation, which it does, of course. So I would say that is the decisive event that started the First World War, the British fleet going up there.
Yeah, and that was a decision by Winston Churchill, who was, what, First Lord of the Admiralty or something like that?
Yeah, right.
And who do you think helped him make that decision?
Well, there was a secret elite. A secret elite planning all this. And if anybody wants to answer that, It's a very important and quite difficult question you just asked. I recommend a book called Hidden History, The Secret Origins of the First World War, by Jerry Docherty and Jim McGregor, who look at basically Grey, Edward Grey and Winston Churchill, the King of England, something called Haldane and Nathan Rothschild, the banker Rothschild. They started printing, get this, special war currency on the 26th of June. That was to pay for everything in the war. So the Bank of England started printing special war currency before any of this had happened. Mm-hmm. As if they, so that was kind of preempting that the war was going to take place. Grey is very duplicitous and two-faced. He has this...
Let's make it clear that Edward Grey was the foreign secretary at the time.
Yeah.
Right? And Asquith was the prime minister.
Yeah.
And he was a member of the Liberal Party.
Liberal Party, yeah.
Yeah. And then Richard Haldane, who I had not heard of before, was the Secretary of War.
Yeah.
For Britain.
Yeah.
So there they were, and Churchill, head of the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
And there they were, these four you make out in your book, that these four were the ones that who were really,
well, let's call them the secret elite. And, Grey had made this alliance with France since about 1905, and it was detailed war plans. The British Expeditionary Force, about 150,000 British troops, would team into France as soon as war broke out, and help to stop Germans from getting anywhere. So that was the plan, and the plan was this whole plan was equivocal and secret. They couldn't tell Parliament or the Cabinet about it because it would be rejected. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
On the contrary, the Parliament kept being assured by the Prime Minister, we're not in any contractual obligation to come into a European war. You know, they kept being told that right up to the last minute, 3rd of August, when Grey makes his speech in the House of Commons, and they suddenly discover none of that is true, and we are obliged to go into war, and we are going into war, and Parliament is more or less told that by Grey on the 3rd. At the core of what brought about this First World War is Britain's commitment to France that in the event of war, it will come in and support France, and France, therefore, has the nerve to go ahead with a war, going a war with Russia against Germany, which otherwise wouldn't have the nerve to do, okay?
Mm-hmm.
When you get Prince Lichnowsky coming on the 1st of August to talk to Grey, if Grey had simply said to him, listen, if there is any, if Germany invades France, the British, 100,000 British troops will automatically team into France in a few days to fight Germany. If he had said that, that would have absolutely prevented the German plan of going into France. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if he had come out and said what the plan was...
And he was talking to the, Lichnowsky was the, German ambassador to Britain.
Exactly, yeah, correct.
Yeah.
He was talking to the German ambassador. When he made his speech to the House of Commons, he didn't even mention this discussion he'd had with Lichnowsky, which was the last final German attempt by the Kaiser to prevent the World War breaking out. He didn't even mention it. And he pretended it was just, it was just a private chat we've had, you know, as if the Foreign Secretary could have a private chat with the German ambassador.
So the whole thing was filled with deception. Because they were maneuvering Germany to attack. They were maneuvering Germany to initiate the war, so then they could blame Germany at the end. They didn't want to be blamed for it.
Yeah. For Germany to initiate the war, had to go through Belgium, and Belgium had to say no when it was asked.
Talk about the Schlieffen Plan.
Plan sounds sort of nightmarish and desperate, but it was the only defense plan Germany had. Once the frightening alliance between France and Russia had been established, the Kaiser was given this plan by the German generals that if Russia is going to attack, then the plan has to be to go in France, beat France first quickly, and then storm over and fight Russia. That you can't fight the two together, but you might be able to beat France first. So that's the kind of Schlieffen plan. And Britain, knowing this plan, have made very detailed war plans with Belgium, okay? And there were Loads of documents found once the war began in the German House of in the Belgian House of Government about these detailed war plans, and all sorts of stores of British ammunition found in Belgium to be used in this event. So Belgium was supposedly in a condition of perpetual neutrality. That was supposed to be the condition of its existence. But the Kaiser realised that actually it made this deal with Britain, be on the side of Britain when war comes. So, in other words, the Kaiser realised that Germany actually had four different nations surrounding it, all hostile. So, you can imagine this terrific, deep, deep fear and paranoia gripping Germany with these hostile nations. A Kaiser did definitely feel, Britain was weaving this plan of encirclement of Germany and planning a war of annihilation.
Mm-hmm.
And the only motive for this was trade, but Britain believed that Germany is getting more and more powerful in Europe, therefore to smash it to bits was a way of increasing British trade. It was a profoundly wicked and immoral philosophy, but that was the attitude. That whenever the Kaiser asked for some treaty of friendship, the Kaiser said to, he said to the British, we're the main land power in Europe, you're the main sea power in the world, couldn't we have a treaty of peace and friendship on that basis that would be, really indestructible? And he was kind of baffled to realise that Britain wouldn't do that. And on the contrary, there was this British war plan, which you could kind of, I would describe as Churchillian in its attitude, that Britain always has to oppose the strongest power in Europe. And that was like the basis of both world wars.
Right. And so the Kaiser wanted, who was half British, wanted friendship with Britain, but Britain did not want friendship with Germany, because it saw Germany as too talented of a competitor, and Britain didn't. Well, I suppose Britain was used to not having to compete. It seems to me that Britain was always more friendly with nations that could not compete equally with them. They knew they were not good at trade and so on or anything. It's always championing those countries and making them allies and so on. And the truly powerful country in Europe, it wants to defeat. And so that was Germany. Before that, it was Spain.
What a wonderful, wonderful 20th century we could have had if Britain wanted to be friends with Germany. What a marvelous culture could have developed in Europe. If only we hadn't had this British warmonger type attitude of always wanting the war. And the other thing I noticed is that the Kaiser was dead keen on the British Empire. He liked it, and he even offered to send troops supporting it if it was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think later on Hitler did much the same thing.
That's right.
Made the same offer because their admiration for the British Empire. So we maybe could still have had the British Empire if we hadn't wanted war with Germany,
But they wanted the United States on their side, but they never wanted Germany on their side.
No. And the other thing to point out is that the way this war was fought, it was right from the start with black propaganda. I mean, why the hell would, this is a great mystery, why the hell would young English people, the flower of British youth, without conscription, volunteer, go out, fight and die in muddy fields with bayonets and gas and bombs, machine guns. Why not just stay at home? The fight against a country that had been friendly with us for 1,000 years and never in any way would ever threatened us, for me, that is the great mystery. Was it just a poster? Is a poster telling them to go out and fight? Or have I missed something?
Well, you talk about that propaganda that came out. That was turned on.
This is the first time that organized hate propaganda was generated by so-called intelligence, British intelligence, ruins up filthy, horrible lies, real lies from hell itself, come out and are given to the young men who believe them, they don't realise their own government is lying to them, they believe these stories, and they go out and fight and kill and die. And the very first act that Britain does after declaring war on Germany, the very first act is to cut the undersea telephone cables from Germany to America. So that there's a one-sided then odds that Britain can give its propaganda to America, and it's not easy for Germany with all its telephone cables cut to match that. So America's whipped up into hating Germany, but the Hun, This is arguably the most civilized culture nation in the world. And it swept up to hate and despise Germany, and somehow believe that it's a threat. Through that propaganda. I've got a very good book on American book actually, on this, which helped to open my eyes what's going on. I just mentioned it's called Propaganda for War by Stuart Halsey Ross. How the United States was conditioned to fight the Great War of 1914-18. And that's a very good review from an American point of view of this terrific mass of atrocity propaganda. And what comes out from that book...
Well, would you say the name of the author again?
Stuart Halsey Ross, R-O-S-S. It's called Propaganda for War.
Okay.
What comes out in that book is that Germany was not generating lies in terms of propaganda for war. I mean, German propaganda would be more in the nature of British politicians being led by the nose by sort of Jewish bankers sort of thing. There'd be sort of that sort of cartoon Germany would produce. But I would say it isn't hate propaganda. It's not untruth. I think that untruth comes out from British and also French and American sources in this war, but not, as far as I can see, not from Germany. I mean, call me naive, but it seems to be one-sided that Germany fights this war in accordance with the Hague Conventions. It doesn't as such target women and children, and it does not generate massive barrage of lies and untruth to motivate its troops to fight, whereas the other side does. I think that's, for me, that is an important asymmetry in this war.
Why this dislike of Germany or a fear of Germany or whatever it is? Why all this ganging up on Germany, even back then? It wasn't because of Adolf Hitler. Then why were they doing it?
Yeah, well, that's the question. Why did it have to happen? Maybe this country has just been kind of addicted to war and can't really live without war. Maybe there's something, you know, a flaw in the character, British character, British soul, but maybe it's Rothschild control of the banking system. And I think there was a time, if you go back to, say, the Merry Monarch, 17th century, where Britain could be happy living without war, and Britain didn't need to have a foreign enemy. It would have one now and then, but it didn't need one. Whereas the nightmare culture we're in now, it always needs somebody to hate and fear. The no good lousy politicians believe that they will get respect if they can make out there's some foreign enemy that we've all got to hate and fear. That's all I can suggest. I mean, Germany and England have been friendly for many centuries, obviously the Kaiser and the King had the same royal family, you know, both descendants of Queen Victoria. The Kaiser was a great lover of things British, admired the British way of life, so I think that is a mystery. I think that, for me, that question you just asked, that is the great mystery. I mean, if any man didn't go out to fight in this war, you know what would happen to him. Mm-hmm. Some young girl would come up and give him a white feather.
Oh.
Okay? And he would curl up and say, oh no, how terrible, oh God, oh she's giving me a white feather. You know.
That meant he was a coward, huh?
Yeah, I mean, a coward.
Yeah. Well, you know, Nick, you have a German name, Kallerström. That's German.
No, it's Swedish. You're not German.
Oh, Swedish. Okay. Oh, you have a Swedish name. All right.
Swedish name. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to get that cleared up. Yeah, it looks more Swedish, doesn't it? Okay, well, is there anything more that you want to tell us about World War I before we go on to World War II?
Well, I think that gives us an outline of it, the way Britain precipitated, and I think the Kaiser did everything he could. He's a wise peacemaker, but he was just outwitted by British diplomacy and encirclement, policy encirclement, but as we're saying, there's a lot in common with the two wars. In both wars, Germany didn't want the war. Germany tried to avoid the war. There was a peace offer on the table from Germany. Britain had wanted it. Britain didn't want it. Britain and Germany, both cases, I would say, more or less won the war. Both fought the war and won it against various European countries. And Britain then only managed to turn the tables by dragging America into the war.
Well, that's right. That's right. And then you talk about outwitting. You know, in both wars, I think Britain outwitted Germany. And Germans are smart, but somehow they don't have that, they don't understand the depth of deviousness that the British carry out. And I wonder if it's because devious people are helping them. I mean, really, why are they so talented in that regard?
Sorry, why who's so talented?
Well, why are the British so talented in being devious? Because they are they just think differently? They're better chess players or something? They outwit the Germans.
Why a war would be wanted, or why the tactics of deception would be used. I think Germans have sort of got something honest and straightforward about German culture, and as you say, they were a bit outwitted. They lost the post-war propaganda.
Some people say that Germany was such a new country that they weren't experienced in global diplomacy the way the British were, and there might be some truth to that.
Maybe. In both cases, it seems to me the point of the war was unconditional surrender. That was what Britain and America wanted. And what is the point of that supposed to be? It means that when you lay down your arms, your enemy can come in and do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what happened. Treaty of Versailles, Germany was chopped up, you know, boundaries that nobody wanted or liked were imposed on Europe, and they were so unstable that they practically made another war inevitable, and impossible reparations were imposed on Germany, quite impossible, and the capital, they then had to sign a document saying it was all their fault. So that was the situation in the first.
And that blockade had a lot to do with that. Blockade.
That had never been unheard of. All through the war, that blockade, 750,000, mainly women and children, starved to death.
Mm-hmm. They did not lift the blockade after Germany signed the surrender. They didn't think it was a surrender. Germany didn't believe they were surrendering, but it turned out it was taken as a surrender.
Well, Germany laid down its arms. It hadn't really been beaten.
They were supposed to all do that. And Germany was supposed to do it first.
I didn't quite follow that.
Oh, I said they were all supposed to lay down their arms. But Germany was supposed to, they told Germany they had to do it first. And then they would do it. But they didn't do it. I mean, that just shows how naive that Germans are. That they think, well, we don't have any choice. They always thought people were going to be honorable. So only honorable people believe other people are going to be honorable. You know, so, you know, that was one of the worst things of all.
I suppose so. Okay, let's move on now, World War II. Now imagine, we've got our tea break, and now I come back and I'm giving this talk on part two. And I'm actually quite scared, Caroline. I've actually had a nightmare the night before. Oh, God, what am I going to do? What am I doing? Because I'm going to give a talk in which I quote Hitler quite respectfully, and...
What group were you talking to?
Well, it's our monthly group called 9/11 Keep Talking.
It's a 9/11 group. Okay.
And it's the remnants of the old 9/11 Truth Group. I was really scared of giving a talk in which I was going to hammer Winston Churchill and describe Adolf Hitler's proposals as quite reasonable.
Because
it's really scared me in terms of my condition all my life, the way I've been told the way things are, and I was going to say it different. So I was really nervous, and I wasn't even sure whether the audience would stand for it.
Right.
You know?
Well, you know, that just goes to show that, like what I said in the beginning, that Britain is far more hardcore on World War II official narrative than a lot of other countries. Are.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. It's like the war is still going on, actually.
Right, right.
Still, you know, damn Nazi is the worst accusation you can hurl at somebody. And Winston Churchill is the man of the century, the favourite Briton of all. So it's still a very strongly polarised in terms of anything published in this country.
So you did good to do that. So you got up and you spoke, and most people there
At the end, I asked people, and they said they felt it was balanced. They felt it was a well-balanced account. That's what they told me. And that gave me the courage to go ahead and publish it. Yeah.
Good. Good.
And I've left in inserts where people from the floor chip in, give us a flavor of what it was like. But it was a real meeting.
Yeah, and it sounded like one person was a little bit hostile, but not a lot, just a little bit.
Yeah, we did have one guy, haven't put all the comments in, yeah.
Well, so then how did it go? Were people surprised? Did they say afterwards that you said some things they didn't know, or were any minds changed?
I felt that we're all kind of relieved to talk about this, and the way in which Britain had precipitated the war. It's quite unequivocal. Britain started a war and doing everything he possibly could to avoid it. And that process of war initiation, which was done mainly by this brandy-drinking, hospitalised alcoholic, Churchill, who got in. He wasn't elected. He took over from Chamberlain. They became the Prime Minister, unelected Prime Minister, and he really started the war.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. So is Churchill the only one who's in both wars, who had played a major role in both?
Yeah.
It's quite amazing. People don't really realize the role that Churchill played in World War I. I don't think they do.
No, in both cases, he could do it single-handed. He ordered the Navy right up north off his own bat as First Sea Lord. And then he could ring, in Second World War, he could ring up Bomber Command and tell them, look, I need 80 planes to go over to bomb the hell out of Berlin. I want a really heavy attack on the city of Berlin. That was in August 1940. He could just do that without cabinet or parliamentary permission, you know. Well, that's how he got the war going.
Yeah, you start out by saying that in 1936, well, I take it that the war with Germany was being planned for then, and Bomber Command was created in that year, and they're building these long-range bombers.
I also got from your book
that the Lancasters were heavy bombers, which no other country had or wanted. They're made for bombing cities, you say.
Exactly, yeah. And I think in America, too, there's something similar. Strategic Air Command was being constructed around that time. So that indicates a plan to bomb cities, which is the worst crime ever conceived by the mind of man, systematic incineration of the cities of Europe. That amazingly wicked plan was being expressed in the design of the plane, whereas French and German planes were, attack-type design, but not designed for that heavy bombing, which wouldn't sort of have occurred to them, that anyone was going to do such a thing.
Yeah, so who was behind that? Because Churchill was still with the Navy, or he was out of power, or what? Who was in charge in 1936?
I'm not sure. I haven't got one particular name then, but that seems to have been, must have been his plan. And right through the 1930s, I then quote various Jewish sources about the coming war. And that's the main source, that a war is going to come in Europe. We are going, Hitler, that may not want a war, but we will force it on him, not this year, but soon. And we will trigger a spiritual and material war of all the world against Germany, and so forth. Our Jewish interests demand the complete destruction of Germany. So there's loads of quotes from Jewish sources. As we all know, in 1933, international Judaism declared war on Germany, and that was a massive economic boycott all around the world, supposed to strangle Germany economically, because it depends on survival for importing food. But despite that, the German economy flourished amazingly well.
Yeah, although it was harmful. It did make an impact on Germany, that Jewish boycott.
Yeah, but
Germany
it
was
amazing
stronger than that, yeah.
The National Socialism was showing the world no other country could do. It's amazing economic recovery in the 1930s, got total full employment, which is, I think, another reason why Germany wouldn't want war. It had a flourishing economy, full employment, had all sorts of stuff that people liked, in a way, it had to be destroyed because it developed its own banking system separate from international Rothschild finance. In fact, Churchill even gives that as one of his reasons for war, that Germany managed to do that, which is pretty amazing. And then once the war started, there are Jewish sources saying, this is our war. We have started it. So, quote, even if we Jews are not bodily with you in the trenches, we are nevertheless with you. This is our war and you are fighting it for us. We always hear non-stop Jewish complaints about them suffering in World War II, but they are the people who claim they're going to start the war, and then when it has started, they took credit for having started. I think that's totally important people realise this. Mm-hmm. And the distinguished Tory MP, Captain Ramsay, in his book, The Nameless War, he said, quote, international Judaism has demonstrated by the course of the 20th century that it could start a war.
Yeah, and you know, there's so much evidence of what's really caused things to happen. But it's always being, you have to keep putting it before people's minds and before, in front of people's attention, because if you don't, the other side is always trying to wipe it away and make it.
Well, we're in a very extraordinary situation. Germany cannot present its own point of view. You know, what we might expect pro-German or use the kind of view we're expressing here cannot be expressed by Germany or in Germany. And that's an extremely bizarre situation, isn't it?
Right. So here we have the first war, which was to destroy Germany. And here's what I got from your book, one of the things. And it appeared that they did. But then this guy, Adolf Hitler, showed up. This guy who's been so demonized. And he brought Germany back. And so they had to fight another war. And this time they said, we're going to really do it. You know, and they also have to destroy Adolf Hitler, the man who stood up to them. So, it's also simple. It's clear. You can't really take it any other way, just like you were talking about some of the things that people were saying.
Well, come on, I'd like to ask you your view about, people say, oh, Hitler's grabbing this and grabbing that. You ask most people why we went to war with Germany.
Good.
Oh, well, first of all, he grabs Austria, then he grabs Czechoslovakia, then he grabs Poland, and that is the way it's seen. Mm-hmm. Now, I tried to give a different view in the book, didn't I?
Yes.
This was this was different peoples who felt they were German, who had been German for centuries, who had the same culture, wanting to live together, wanting to be in the same country, and of one culture. And most notably, and I emphasize that when he went into Germany Austria or the Sudetenland in Czechoslovakia, that the German troops were greeted by cheering crowds, throwing flowers in their path. It was not a military conquest. Well, say with Austria, when the German tanks rolled into Austria and greeted the cheering crowds, at the same time, Austrian tanks or the Austrian army was rolling into Germany. So they made it symmetrical, okay?
Right.
For this act of union, this was an act of union. I would say it's kind of ceremony of union of two parts of a country that they'd given a geographical boundary and wanted to be one, that the armies went into each other at the same time. And I would say that can in no way be described as invading Austria.
Well, that how they convinced people that Germany invaded Austria against its will, it's just total and pure fantasy. But they got a lot of people believing it. But speaking about the German people being separated, that was the desire to destroy Germany as any kind of a powerful force in Europe. That was how they did it, you know, as part of how they did it, to destroy the unity of the people, and gave a lot of land to all these other countries with Germans in it. And so what Hitler was doing was bringing them back together, and that is seen as what you said, attacking other countries.
Yeah. For example, there were several million who were put into Czechoslovakia, the Czechoslovakia is a country that didn't really want to exist. The different bits were put together, didn't want to be together.
No, and after World War I, Austria requested that it could be a part of Germany. It didn't want to be separate, but it was refused, and all these people were refused.
Yeah, right. Well, they kept talking about the right of determination of small nations. You know,
self-determination, self-determination.
And that was partly an explanation of what the point of the First World War had been. you know, oh, we're defending Belgium, the small nations must have the right of autonomy and self-determination. America liked that as a kind of mantra for breaking up the British Empire, which it wanted to do. The question was, if that was being repeated, could that apply to other bits wanting to join Germany, like the Sudetenland and Czechoslovakia? Were they allowed to rejoin Germany? There's a bit that nobody ever mentioned, very hard to get anything about, that were they being mistreated? Were the Sudetens being badly treated by the Czechoslovak government, which is why they wanted to rejoin Germany? It's quite difficult to get anything on this, so I didn't say much about it. But seems to me what's important here is that the Munich Agreement, for this to happen, was signed by four nations, okay? Italy, France, Germany, and England. All my life, I've heard the Munich Agreement as this old, lovely old guy, Chamberlain, coming back to England, the Prime Minister, with a bit of paper signed by Hitler. And what an idiot to trust Hitler, you know. It's never said that this was four different nations got together and agreed on the right of these Germans to become part of the German nation.
That's right. Yeah. So, and you are a fan of Patrick Buchanan.
I think he did very good work. That's a wonderful book, book, The Unnecessary War. I think he's a very wise American, and I recommend everyone listening to this program to get that copy on the shelf, because it's a kind of reasonable book that most people would see as very sensible and well-balanced, you know. Mm-hmm. There are other more kind of revisionist books, like the one I just mentioned about the First World War, that wouldn't be reviewed in normal, you know, normal published media, would be thought of beyond the fringe. And various revisionist books, you know, we could mention in this regard. Like I mentioned the one, The Bad War by Mike King, okay, which, you know, I recommend that. And I think that is selling very well. I think it's having a big effect. But that Patrick Buchanan book is quite a mainstream work. Mm-hmm. You know?
He goes quite far in it. So that's the great trick, you know, to be able to say as much truth as you can and still stay within where you can. Of course,
does describe the Dunkirk episode, for example, which is so important that people realise that, recognise that. I mean, all my life I've heard Dunkirk as a miraculous escape of the British people and, you know, the amazing pluck whereby they managed to survive. And you never hear it said that it was Hitler himself who intervened, told the German troops not to go in and let them go, because he somehow thought that would lead to some sort of understanding or good relations between the countries.
Right.
A main axiom in his foreign policy, and this I found amazing researching the subject, for friendship with Britain, is always striving how could goodwill and friendship with Britain be achieved. And it somehow failed in the last World War. He felt it failed because Germany built up its navy too much, which competed with the British navy, and it shouldn't have done that. And his philosophy was if Germany was more just a land power, it could avoid that competition.
Right. Kaiser did too in World War I, was trying to get along.
Well, perhaps we could come on to what happened when Churchill became Prime Minister. That was on May the 7th.
Yeah, let's do, but let's also say, I want to say here, you mentioned that Hitler did not have any plan to invade Poland, that wasn't part of his whole plan, but he wanted to be on good neighbor terms with Poland.
Yeah.
But Poland, again, didn't want to be on good neighbor terms with Germany. It really didn't.
Yeah, it's hard to believe this, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Polish quote is wanting war with Germany, and it believed Germany was totally demoralized after the Versailles Treaty. It believed it had a larger army than Germany. It believed it could win. Well, there had been a non-aggression pact that Hitler signed in 1934, mm-hmm. a 10-year non-aggression pact with Poland, right? So that clearly existed, and it shows Germans' intention that there was that pact signed. And that was kind of broken when a new Prime Minister came into Poland, and instead, you get 1938, you get a British war guarantee given to Poland. And that is unconditional. Any way that Poland gets into a scrap with Germany, Britain will support Poland.
Right.
So that shows
the same thing is like with between Britain and Belgium in World War I. They kind of conjured up this treaty between them.
Yeah, maybe. Well, Patrick Buchanan says that's the biggest strategic blunder that Britain ever made in its history, that war guarantee to Poland. which dragged it into a war in a totally pointless manner. Because
but it wasn't a blunder. It wasn't a blunder in Britain's eyes because they wanted the war.
Well, okay, if they did want the war, then that was certainly the way to do it. It led to very, very truculent behaviour by Poland. And what I also found researching this book was that there was absolutely massive aggravation of Germans. There's about 2 million or more than 2 million Germans living in that bit of Poland near the border. And there was massive propagation. About 1 million of them had to flee their houses. There was totally intolerable persecution, provocation, and mass murder of the Germans living in Poland. There was an ethnic cleansing going on. Okay?
Correct.
Poland deciding want to get these Germans out. By doing that, they forfeited their rights to that country. The Treaty of Versailles, let's just be clear, this bit on the western side of Poland, they grabbed that after Germany had surrendered at the end of the war. They grabbed it. Treaty of Versailles then ratified that, said, okay, you can keep that, provided you treat the German inhabitants well. Well, it hadn't treated them well, and so in 1939, Germany went in to Poland up to the old traditional border of Germany. So land that had been for many centuries German simply became German again. And I'm very doubtful whether you can describe that as a war of aggression. They were just reclaiming what had long been Germany, what was taken away from Germany without any right. And the intolerable persecution of Germans was going on then. So they went in up to the old boundary of Germany. So I can't see anything very immoral or wrong with that. And also, Ribbentrop had absolutely assured Churchill that this would not activate the British War Guarantee.
He reassured Hitler, you mean?
Yeah, he reassured Hitler this would not activate the British War Guarantee, especially because Russia was going to come in and take the other half of Poland. So it did, and then Hitler was furious with Ribbentrop because he trusted him. And that was how he was kind of entrapped into the war.
Right.
But I don't think there's anything else he could have done. He couldn't have just left it. See, that intolerable
No, he couldn't have left. He couldn't have allowed that treatment. And the Poles kept increasing the persecution and the mistreatment of the Germans in order to make Hitler act. So this was, you know, this was another plan, encirclement plan that they had going on. It wasn't that Hitler wanted the war. He never wanted...
Let's just go on that one more time. The initial proposal Hitler made to Poland was just for a railway line and a road to be built through a corridor to join up with Gdansk. Is that right? That was the part of Germany on the coast. There's a bit of Germany, totally German bit of land that they wanted to join up with and the Treaty of Versailles destroys any connection, so they wanted a railway line connecting. And that was his proposal.
Right.
Poland didn't even reply to that letter, did they?
No, they replied to some things, and they said, oh, we're never going to discuss this again. We don't bring this up again. But the final thing that Hitler sent, you know, was kind of an ultimatum. That doesn't mean it was unfriendly, but it's called an ultimatum that they wanted an answer from Poland on the proposals that they had sent. And diplomatically, you have to do that, but Poland was just ignoring it. This was right at the end, you know, like August 29th. So that's the one that they didn't respond to, and Hitler was just infuriated. By then, you know, he says that's when he said we're declaring war on Poland.
Yeah. Right. So I think that was totally reasonable to defend Germans.
He had to do it.
We've got to stop Hitler. And nearly everybody in this country believes that. We have to stop Hitler.
Right.
As if he was just land grabbing here and there and here and there. It's only the British who were able to stand up to him.
Yeah, and fact, you know, if we hadn't gone to war, we British would now be speaking German. Things like that they don't say as a joke. I mean, they're serious about it. And when all the evidence is that all Germany wanted was to be friends with Britain, they never wanted to invade Britain.
Yeah, it wanted friends, and it wanted various bits of German country and land to be part of Germany. I mean, the question was, the big question in the 20th century was, could the different bits of Europe that felt they were German be allowed to come together and be Germany? That was the question.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was no. The answer was no. No, that must lead to war. And it did lead to war.
Yeah, so let's go on to Churchill now.
Okay. Well, as soon as he gets there, it's the 10th of May. On the 11th of May, the British Air Force starts bombing German cities. Now, this is a totally new new step in human history. The deliberate targeting of women and children, of undefended cities, with high-flying bombers. And that is, nobody had done this before. There was, for example, an attack on Danzig when Poland was invaded. But that was part of a bombardment, and every notice had been given, and various ultimatums had been given, and I gather that is allowed under the Hague Convention, okay?
Well, how did Churchill become Prime Minister? You said he wasn't elected.
No, it wasn't. It was something about Chamberlain. The Munich Agreement was regarded as having gone bad, when Hitler something about Czechoslovakia, and they created some protectorate because the country was falling apart.
Yeah.
He in some way created a protectorate to keep the country together, and that was regarded as by Chamberlain as breaking the spirit of the Munich Agreement. And I think after that, he was very old and ill, and he was dying. I think after that, he had to resign, and somehow Churchill got in.
Vote of the people in Parliament.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Okay, now there's a terribly important 3-month period that my book emphasizes between May 1940 when Britain starts bombing the cities of Germany and September when Germany finally responds 3 months later. And in that period, Hitler is giving all sorts of peace offers to Britain, very quite reasonable peace offers to withdraw from occupied territories
He was even going to withdraw from Poland and give all that territory they had won back to Poland.
Was he? Yeah.
Yeah, that was the final one.
Yeah. And also to try and guarantee Czechoslovakia. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were offering everything they possibly could.
Right.
With a peace deal. I could perhaps mention a book here, or an author, who's done a lot of research on these peace offers, because they're generally very forbidden. Hushed up thing, you know. That called Martin Allen. He wrote 3 books on this subject. So it's called, no, inappropriate titles, Himmler's Secret War. It's about the peace offers that Himmler kept making, or that went through Himmler all the time during the war.
Yeah, I read one book by that author, and I liked it very much. It was the book he wrote about Rudolf Hess.
I'd like to
read these others.
I think this guy's been bumped off now. I think he's totally invisible and unattainable. I think he annoyed the establishment.
They went after him.
And I think he's dead now, Martin Allen.
Yeah, he is.
We tried hard to find him. I think right after his 3rd book came out, which was massively discredited by British establishment through the Daily Telegraph, even though other people said it was spot on, I think he might have vanished. Anyway, I just mentioned him as being a very good source for the peace offers that happened during this very important 3-month period. Generally, there's a historian, David Irving, right? And he's the guy whose history really describes this asymmetry. And I think this asymmetry really demonstrates who wanted the war, that once Britain started bombing Germany, but for several months Hitler was kind of desperately trying to make offers of peace. And let's bear in mind that Dunkirk episode we just talked about, I think that was July 1940, that was during this period, okay? Mm-hmm. He was making a speech how very important friendship and goodwill was with Britain. That was at the same time that the British government was bombing the cities of Germany. And then the big climax came in August. Churchill was very frustrated that Hitler wasn't responding, because he knew that the way to get the war going, which he wanted, was to have Germany bomb London, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the terrible, nightmare, hellish logic that was going through Churchill's mind. He wanted the war, I just said again, he wanted the war, and he knew the British people didn't want war, and he realised the one way to get the war going was to provoke Germany to bomb London. And that's what he wanted. So, middle of August, he sends through, he uses some pretext, as a pretext of a German bomber accidentally flying a bit too far and dropping some bombs on an area of London. German fighters were under very strict orders only to bomb industrial targets, okay?
Mm-hmm.
He sends AC planes, British planes, out to bomb Berlin. So heavy bombing of Berlin takes place. And even then, amazingly enough, Germany does not respond. Hitler desperately does not want war with Britain. And not until the 6th of September does he finally respond. And this is what British people call the Blitz. The whole of East London goes up in flames, okay? And Churchill's finally got what he wants. And he knows he's got a lovely, lovely long war now. The British people never, ever acknowledge that this Blitz is a response to us starting to bomb Germany for 3 whole months first. For me, this is a staggering, awesome thing about my fellow countrymen, that they regard the Blitz as proof of Hitler's wickedness, okay?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, I know how people believe the Blitz was the worst thing that some people who are either British or British sympathetic think that the Blitz was the worst bombing event that ever took place in the world. Oh, yeah. The Blitz.
Yeah. And I don't acknowledge there's a 20-to-1 ratio of the tonnage of bombs we dropped on Germany compared to what they dropped on us.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So what we got in the Blitz was 5% of the total bombs dropped in World War II. There's 2.5 million tons of bombs dropped in the middle of Europe, Great Britain and America in World War II. And just think about that for a minute. All the time, the Germans were bombing Britain. It was a reprisal. It was in the nature of a reprisal. And all the time, a peace offer was on the table. You stop bombing us, we'll stop bombing you. And I find that British people don't know about this, or they don't want to know about it, or they don't believe you if you try to tell them.
Yes, and then what I think is the real key to the whole thing is you have a couple of quotes from Churchill here that I really liked. And the first one is, you must understand this war is not against Hitler or National Socialism, but against the strength of the German people, which is to be smashed once and for all. You know, what a statement. I don't know when or where he said that, but I have read it before.
That's his philosophy, is to sort of smash Germany. And that's his philosophy. That's the point of the war. If you ask what was the point of the war was smash Germany.
I get that from the First World War. They didn't succeed. I said before, they didn't succeed in smashing Germany. It came back again. So now he was very clear that this is what his job was to do, to smash Germany once and for all. And you say in the book that he achieved that because of the condition of Germany today.
Oh, yeah. Well, they crushed Germany physically and spiritually, and that is what the Jewish source said before the war began. It was the purpose of the operation, and they did that spiritually, if one may use the phrase, at Nuremberg, with the monster lies, which they forced Germany to accept and internalise. And unlike the First World War ended with all of the lies of British intelligence being discredited, okay? And that then led to a low opinion of British intelligence, you know, for some years. Oh, God, the filthy lies they made up, causing everyone to fight. And now that didn't happen in the Second World War. Second World War, the monster untruth they dreamed up, what Germany had been up to, was consecrated at Nuremberg and accepted by everyone, and as we all know, it still is today.
Right, and the Holocaust is what has helped that
case. Well, that is the story, yeah, that is it. So Germany gets crushed by the war, and its cities are reduced to rubble, and Britain and America want the moral high ground. They turn the cities into cities of Middle Europe, lovely, wonderful cultural treasures of Middle Europe, are reduced to rubble, and they started the war, but they want to get the moral high ground. And they can do this if they can make up this story. So various different people have an interest in making up the same story about the gas chambers at the end of the war and then forcing Germany by law to believe it.
And then this time they occupied Germany so that they took control of Germany. And they put their own puppets in charge. You said earlier that Germany won't stand up for itself. And this is
that means we have a culture in which Europe cannot trust itself. The The two Saxon countries, if I'm going to put it that way, Germany and England, which never ever fought each other, them having these two terrific wars means that Europe is had its self-confidence destroyed, its optimism of self-confidence has been destroyed by these incredibly pointless wars, and it all ends with Churchill giving half of Europe to Stalin, Jewish Bolshevism, and the other half gets taken over by NATO, which is American, or occupied by, means we have a Europe which does not have self-confidence, which doesn't trust itself, you know?
That's beautifully stated, Nick. So good. That's true.
Well, that's the terrible sort of destiny we've got now, of Europe doesn't have self-confidence in whatever whatever it might be able to do. And it has these dreadful memories of this war. So, but I feel that German country is so important, or would be so important if it get itself together, in preventing the world from destroying itself. I wonder if this kind of historical exercise we're doing could help Germans could get their self-confidence back again.
Well, that would be great. It's wonderful that you have put it together in this nice little package here, so that so many people can get the message and see what they think about it. You know, it's very well put together. And, one thing here that you say that I wrote down, again, I'm on the same theme, I guess. Churchill also said, our aim is victory at all costs. And that's just the way the people who supported him think, you know, that at all costs, they don't care what it costs. They want their way, you know, they want to achieve their goals, and it doesn't matter what the cost is. And of course,
the cost is that we all end up in debt to Rothschild bankers, huge national debt, and so countries lose their sovereignty and autonomy. We can always be manipulated by the bankers in the future.
That's exactly.
Through debts. You know?
That's the situation we're in. That's right.
And it also means that, we've got a horrible, crummy civilization which always has a demonic enemy, the demonized, what I call the phantom menace, which is brewed up, so that politicians can control citizens through fear, which is a very negative and unpleasant culture to live in, you know. It's done that with Germany, brewed up these nightmare images that stoke up for the entertainment industry.
You're right.
So you can't stop intelligence from blowing up these images. But once the war is over, so-called intelligence, which has created these ghastly lies, said, we helped you to win the war, didn't we? So you need us, don't you? So it's still there. And create false news and false intelligence whenever it wants. And feel virtuous about it. Which is obviously the world we live in now.
Yeah. Yeah, yes it is. And it always comes back in my mind to, well, it comes down to the media. That's not the bottom of it, but real, in our day-to-day life, it's control of the media that we can't get the message out to people very easily and only to a limited amount of people. And this is where we got ourselves in, hot water, that's for sure. In solving this. But Nick, you're a real hero for all the books you've written and all the work you've done. You really are. You've worked on, all that important work on 7/7, the British, 9/11. And, you've done a lot in 9/11. And then you went and got into Holocaust revisionism. And you grab hold of things and get the essence of it so very well. And I loved your book. I loved Breaking the Spell, and we did a show on that. And now this next little book. Have you written anything in between since Breaking the Spell before this one?
Well, I have actually. It's on a rather different thing. It's not really political. But, yeah, I did another one. It's about the Beatles story with Paul McCartney.
Okay.
I can send you a copy one day if you like. It's sort of a bit of light reading for you.
Yeah, I'd like that. Okay, well, so you keep very busy, and I want to thank you for having this discussion with me today.
Well, I thought it was a great discussion. I really appreciate it. So I feel that we did really examine the issues quite well, you know.
Good. Well, we'll reach as many people as we can with this. So thank you very much, Nick.
Okay, Caroline. Sure for now.
Okay. That was Nicholas Kollerstrom, ladies and gentlemen, talking about his new book, How Britain Initiated Both World Wars, which is available at Amazon for only $5 or £4 in Britain. Nick has a website. It's http://terrorontheTube.co.uk. Give it a look. This is Carolyn Yeager at carolynyeager.net, where this podcast will be archived under the Heretics Hour. Thanks for listening.